everyone. Welcome to episode 39 of Two Guys, Zero Planners. I promise we still remember how to do this podcast thing, I think. It's been an interesting year. Anyways, Urban and I figured that just the two of us talking together is probably not a good thing after a long hiatus. So we're going to break the radio silence and have a third person with us again. It's not Phil, so I apologize for the dad joke purists out there. But we've got something almost as good, and that is Fig Boot on Pens. So, David, welcome to the occasional chaos that is Two Guys.
Thank you for having me on this international podcast.
It's only international because Urban's here and some guy from the, what is that podcast, 18-something or other?
1857.
Yeah, those guys. They're going to hate me for that now. anyways, how have you been, Urban? You've been off doing other podcast things.
Yes, I have been off doing other podcasts, so I now have a programming / management podcast. We just released our 9th episode this week, and other than that, I have just been trying to get through life, basically, and not doing much other things.
Is that podcast in English or German?
Yes, it's English. So you have a German and an Italian speaking English.
Interesting.
And we're both from Munich. So, and we have only met once in passing, but not really.
How does that work? I mean, how did you two decide to go from one passing meeting to let's podcast?
Well, I just had the feeling that she would be the perfect partner for that podcast, and it turns out I was right, and it's a lot of fun to do. We do it every 2 weeks, and if you're interested, you can find it at expandingbeyond.it.
Is that the name of the podcast, Expanding
Yes,
Beyond?
Expanding Beyond, yeah.
Yeah, we'll definitely get that added in the show notes. I've also learned that now I have to start scheduling around Mrs. Urban podcasting as well.
Yes, hers is called Borderline Genius, and she's doing a podcast about being a writer and an editor and stuff like that. And she's been doing, I don't know how many episodes. I haven't kept up.
Well, you have definitely been busy.
Well, at least I don't have to do the editing on that show. She does it all herself, which is nice.
Well, I mean, if she's a borderline genius, then she should be able to figure it out.
Yeah, that definitely goes with the title. What have you been up to since the last time you were on the show, Fig Boot?
Basically, we've been, I've been hiding away in the home, and I can't remember how long ago it's been, but been working from home ever since the end of March, and I can remember leaving the office at the end of March and talking to coworkers going, man, it'll be crazy if we're like home for the whole month of April. Man, how crazy would that be? And that was rather naive for us to say that, considering the fact that there's no current plans for us to even come close to coming back to the office. But working from home has worked out well for me. I've been very productive. There's less people knocking on my office door wanting things, less distractions, and get a little bit more done. So I have no complaints. The commute is a little bit better, a lot better.
Yeah.
And so I have no complaints, and while I miss all of my coworkers and, miss speaking to them in passing, that for the most part, as far as, work has gone, that I've been very, very proficient here at home. And so there's no issues with that. But yeah, the whole family is just staying safe and pretty much hunkered down and not going out that much and getting groceries delivered and just being as careful as we can until this passes over.
Do your kids still go to school? How's
yes.
that working?
Yes, we have two that are in high school right now, and both of them are going virtual. And so right now it's working well. And so we have our time during the day where everyone is working and going to school, and they're attending their different classes in, I don't want to say Zoom, it's a different program they're using, but something similar to that. And so Things are getting done and they're moving on. So, you know, is it an ideal situation? No, but we're making the best of it.
Yeah, luckily ours went back to school after the summer holidays, which is nice for everyone, I think.
Well, I don't have any children to worry about. And
yes, you do. You have two of them.
Yeah, but they don't have to go to school.
They just do stuff with pens sometimes.
We'll talk about that later. That in and of itself is a horrible story, but back in March, my coworkers and I, we kind of had the same jokes that David's did. We were just sitting there going, man, maybe we'll be back in May, maybe we'll be back in June. The people above the people above the people above us let it out in not quite uncertain terms that it may actually be mid-2021 before we actually know what an office looks like again. So I decided to go ahead and turn a door into a desk, so I've got plenty of desk space now. And it's amazing. On the left-hand side of the door desk, I've got my YouTube set up, and on the right-hand side of the door desk, I've got my work set up, which is also my gaming setup, and my TV, because I don't own a TV, which is kind of weird.
It's kind of funny because my company historically has been very slow to embrace new technology and very straight-laced. And like when this is before all of this happened, I wanted to get a Zoom account so we could do some customer training. And I had to go through an ungodly amount of approvals in order to purchase a Zoom account because it was against our IT protocol and things like that. And it's funny how, you know, it was so tight and strict about things like that, and working from home took an act of God, and how all of a sudden now that we're forced to do things, then all that went out the window. And now, you know, HR is using my Zoom account that I purchased to do all of their interviews for new employees and things like that. And so it's how it went from, you know, so restrictive to now we're embracing everything we can to get things done. So I overall, it's kind of good that we're embracing more of that technology, especially since we are a Fortune 500, very large company. But it's kind of sad that it took a worldwide pandemic for us to kind of embrace some of that technology a little bit more.
See, and I find it funny that you work for a technologically backwards-ish company now when you used to work for Razer.
Yes, I was one of, I'll say one of the founders, or one of the founding employees, I'll say that, of Razer. I was employee number 7.
You helped single-handedly make sure that my grades slipped in 9th and 10th grade, so I thank you for that.
some of the things I directly contributed, I helped choose the logo. There was three of us who were, we had a whole bunch of sample logos, and the little three-headed snake that's the logo was the one that we decided on. Like when I came onto the company, we didn't have a full product yet. We just had a plastic prototype. There wasn't anything out in the market yet. And the original prototype on the mouse wheel did not have clicks. It was smooth. And as soon as I felt that, I said, no, we got to change that. We need clicks on this. You can't have it 100% smooth. And so, that's another one of my, couple of little things that, you know, at least, you know, you make a personal difference in. But it was fun because when I was brought onto the company, like I said, we didn't even have a product in the market yet. And so there was very much an I did that factor and a pride in that, where a lot of times you kind of come into companies and you're like, what difference do I make? What difference am I making here in the grand scheme of things? And when I joined that company, you could very much make a difference. And we would sit down at a table with the management team, and it wasn't what are the rules we have to follow, it is what do we want the rules to be, what do we, you know, what is the direction of marketing that we want to go in, and what is the image that we want our product to have? And so I kind of came on to the company when we didn't even have a product yet. We just had technology and we were in development all the way to where we ended up launching the product. And so then when you went into, you know, Best Buy or some store, you saw it on the shelf. And then there was, you know, there was a lot of pride in that, to where you knew what went into getting that item on the shelf. And then what happened was we'll call it the original iteration in the early 2000s, faded away after after a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And then was kind of on life support in name only for quite some time. And the Razer that it is known now, we'll just call it Razer 2.0. They had one person in management who came over, who I don't believe is, I think he's retired since, but we'll just call it, this is like the second iteration of the company. So I'm happy to see that success that they're having. I'm a little jealous that we didn't, weren't able to achieve that success when, we'll just say, we originally were trying with this company. But in some ways I'm happy, and in some ways I'm jealous, just because it would have been nice to see something all the way through like that, as opposed to having the bumps in the road when we did, where basically the company went away for quite some time.
And I mean, it's kind of interesting with you having done stuff with Razer, because you've got products that ended up coming out later, I think during version 2.0, like the Nostromo and the Death Adder. And nowadays you see those copied everywhere, like the 20 button MMORPG mice and the left hand peripherals that are literally just the left hand side of a keyboard and like a D-pad. You see those everywhere now, which actually kind of segues into a stationary related topic. Moonman and cloning things, but good clones that actually are decent and decently priced. So, Urban, I actually jumped down the rabbit hole of buying a couple Moonmen before everything went sideways with the whole car thing. I still have the Moonmen, surprisingly.
Which one did you get? Which ones?
I got the Shinobi clone.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got the Twisby clone, the T1.
Twisby. Yeah, I wouldn't call it a Twisby clone, but yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to call it a Twisby clone. You look at it, and it's close. It's missing a few key features that make Twisby a Twisby.
So which one? The aluminum or the brass one?
I got the aluminum because both of you guys remember the Twisby 580 ALR Prussian Blue video that I made, where I said the knurling was the worst thing ever.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone said I had tiny girl hands because I didn't like knurling, which was kind of interesting. Well,
naturally.
Exactly, naturally, because it's the internet. I went ahead and decided I really liked Prussian Blue, so I'm going to find something that looks like Twisby
mm-hmm.
with Prussian Blue that I could actually hold and write with. And it turns out the T1 happened to be that pen.
Yeah. Do you like it?
Yes. I will probably never buy another Twisby. I like how the section on the Moonman feels compared to an Eco and a 580.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, plus it has a nice number 6 size nib. And I've heard, so Fudafran from the Tokyo Inklings podcast, he put a platinum 3776 nib into his without any modification. So that works too. And I've put in Bock nibs, and some people have put in Jovo nibs. So it's an ideal pen to put in whatever nib you have, basically.
Now, I don't want to go down a rabbit hole that this could potentially bring up, but I had a review of the Moonman T2 on my channel for a few days, and it's the only video I've ever taken down. Mainly because that's the T2 is the Stipula clone.
Yes.
And I will say that my research failed me, and I did not realize that it was a Stipula clone. And mm-hmm. so that's the reason I took it down, was because I felt I misrepresented the pen. One is I didn't want to promote the pen that was such a blatant copy of a different model. But then also I felt that since I did not represent it as a copy of that other model, it kind of misrepresented the pen as opposed to during the review saying, hey, this is a blatant, I don't want to say ripoff or a blatant copy of this Stipula model. So yes, I had it up for a few days and then I took it down. But yeah, that's the only video I've ever taken down, and it was just because I didn't feel good about it.
And I would say that makes perfect sense. Like, I'm not gonna review the C1 because it's a Shinobi clone. It is a one-for-one Shinobi clone. The T1, I can actually feel comfortable reviewing it because if you put it side by side with any Twisby that's out there, there are enough differences. So it's one where you can say inspired by, but not direct copy. And yes, I think I will probably use that line in my review. So let me go ahead and type that down so I don't forget it.
You know, I actually have a video that I've been debating doing, basically called Inspired By or Ripoff, or Inspired By or Knockoff, something along those lines, to where you're broaching the topic of, you know, is this pen inspired by this other pen, or is it a blatant ripoff of this other pen?
And then afterwards, you'll need this, I don't know, what looks like a stamp at the end, like where it says either ripoff or inspired by, right?
Something like that. But, you know, it's, if you ever watch my review, I tend to skew very positive. I don't just go on long rants and rage on things. And even if I do have issues, I kind of approach it in a positive fashion. Sometimes you have to read through the lines to where I'm saying something negative about the pen, but sounding in a positive way. And so it's one of those things I want to carefully word and make sure that it's carefully done. Just like I did a review a long time ago about pens I regret buying. And it was all about ones that I, you know, regretted buying, but I kind of did it in a way to where I was like, hey, I regretted buying this Faber-Castell, but then I really enjoy this other one. And so I kind of, again, kind of skewed positive saying, hey, these are the things that didn't work for me about this pen, but hey, here's another pen from the same manufacturer that I do like, and this is why. So I kind of, you know, skew positive even when I'm talking about negative things, so to speak. But having a video about whether things, first of all, it's controversial because it brings out opinions from people who have strong opinions on both sides. There's people that that don't care that, hey, as long as I can buy this pen for $20, I don't care who it's ripping off, you know, and it's not hurting anybody. And then there's other people who are, you know, hey, I do not want to take part of, you know, and reward anyone for any copyright infringement that's coming typically from Asian countries that where things like that can't be enforced. So it's controversial because there's people who have strong opinions on both sides. And so it's figuring out, you know, how to do it in the best way so that you're, I don't want to say placating both sides, but you're not infuriating both sides.
Yeah, there is that tightrope that we walk. So like in the whole job interview thing, or not job interview, but job performance thing where you're supposed to do the compliment sandwich, good thing, improvement thing, good thing. I try to do that on my reviews too. So like when I'm doing the final wrap up at the end, I'll try to get like 4 or 5 points about the product that are good. And then like the one thing I would change to make it better. I think there was one where it was literally nothing but negative, and I was trying to spin all those negatives, but I can't quite remember the video because I think I've had some vodka since then.
Just because you said job interview, it made me think of something. In my career, I have to do lots of interviews and interviewed lots of people. And every once in a while, someone will ask, you know, hey, like, what's the worst answer that anyone ever gave in a job interview? And that's easy, very simple. Because I used to ask a question about what your favorite book was, or what was the last book you read. It's not an important question. There's no right or wrong answer. It's just basically to have me get you talking about something that you're interested in. And maybe you talk about, you know, hey, the last book I read was this, and just to get you talking about something that you have an interest in and are passionate about. And or, you know, you might say, hey, I don't read books, and there's no right or wrong answer until this one lady answered. And she lit up and just kind of, you could just tell she got excited and say, oh, I have a copy of Mein Kampf on my bookshelf or on my bookstand. And I really admire Hitler. and I am fascinated by this book. And so I'm trying to like hold it in, going, did this woman really just said she admired Hitler? Now, in my time, I've thought about reading that book just from a historical standpoint, okay? Just to say, okay, learning about a subject. And if you came to me right. saying, hey, I read this because I want on a historical level to learn about this and learn about this time in history. And I can understand that fascination in wanting to learn and understand what it is. It's a book that's been referenced for, what, 70, 80 years. You know, at least understand what it really is. But no, she was like, I admire Hitler. And I think she was kind of trying to say she admired just the fact that someone was able to lead people or drive them in certain ways, whether that, you know, not the best way, but at least basically gain control. But
so she went full on Godwin's Law during the interview.
Yeah. And so if you ever want to say, what is the one thing you should not say in a job interview? I admire Hitler is probably at the top of the list.
How do you segue from worst job interview question ever to working through ink samples? I don't think there's a segue for that. So Urban, how's your journey been through your ink samples?
Yes. So, since the last time we recorded, I think I only bought 2 pens. And during that time, my wife also stopped working in science, so she doesn't have a big income. So I basically didn't have much money to buy more pens. So instead, I looked at what I have, and what I had was like 150 ink samples, maybe, that I hadn't really used. So that's what I started to do since then. I've been trying to get through as many as possible. And to help with that, looking at the pens I have inked, I think the finest I have inked right now is a broad nib. And then there's double broads and pilot parallels and Fuda nibs and stuff like that.
So, wow. Yeah. I remember when you were on your extra fine kick.
Yes, I still have those pens, but... Yeah, I for my next bullet journal, I'm using a blank one because then I can write bigger, because 5mm dot grid is a bit small for those big nibs, of course.
Wow, have I rubbed off on you in a bad way?
I don't know. I'm right. It's really weird. I recently got back my Pelikan M205 highlighter pen. So it's a M205 with a double broad nib. Mm-hmm. And I remember it being super, super broad and almost unusable. And then I inked it up again and I thought, huh, that's not bad. That's totally fine to use daily. So somehow it's changed a bit. And broad is okay. Medium is just super fine and not really useful.
So here's the big question. And definitely for you as well, David. When it comes to nib size, which nib size do you prefer? Like, where is home for you?
I know that sounds boring, but I've been kind of a medium guy for quite some time. And, you know, every once in a while I'll branch out, but for the most part, you know, that's the first place I'm going.
Okay. So of the mediums that you've mediumed through, which medium has been your medium?
Well, I did just come out with a video last week, or actually this, you know, a few days ago, about listing my top 10 nibs. And it was an interesting process going through the collection and trying to figure out what was going to make the list and what was some of the criteria I was going to be using. So I decided to kind of focus more on performance. It wasn't just about looks or the pen, and it was more on just the nib itself. And while there was an extra fine and a couple of fines that made the list, the majority of the pens were mediums that ended up making the list.
So without actually going into the full list, because people need to actually watch the video for that, what were some of the highlights of that, or some of the honorable mentions, or like even some of the non-honorable mentions where they came close, but it was a no cigar situation?
You know, I mentioned this in the video, but my goal was, you know, it was the Hall of Fame, not the Hall of Very Good. So there was when I started off, I was saying, okay, what nibs deserve to be potentially mentioned? And I came up with like 30 pens that I could have added to a list. And I said, well, that's way too many. And I cut that down to 20 and then finally ended up with 13, to where I had a top 10 and then three honorable mentions. And then I actually did a poll on YouTube for viewers to say what they what nib was their favorite, and the top three from the user poll did not make my list. So I had a separate honorable mention for the three that were the top mentioned on their list, which were the let's see, it was the Pilot 823, the Pilot Falcon, and then the Lamy 2000 were the top three that were mentioned by viewers as far as their favorites.
Yeah, none of those would be on my list either.
And then we'll just say my three honorable mentions were it was a Pelican M1000, a Mont Blanc 149, and a Pelican M805, well, or 800 series. Those were my three honorable mentions that came the closest. And there were several others that came very close as well to making it. I actually had two stainless steel nibs on the list. So they weren't all gold nibs, but something like the Diplomat Arrow was very close to potentially making it on the list, but I included a different stainless steel, we'll call it more reasonably priced pen on the list.
I've got to say the Arrow nib is actually one of the better out-of-the-box experiences that I've had with a nib.
I actually prefer their stainless steel nib to their gold nib, because I have one of each, and I personally think that the stainless steel one outperforms the gold one.
Haven't tried the gold, but I will definitely take that into consideration. I would say the top three, I would say my top nib that I've ever used. Man, it's so hard because it's a tie between...
Okay, the Varsity didn't make the list, okay? I'm just going to tell you right there. I don't want to disappoint you.
don't be dishing on my number three choice. It's actually the Nakaya nibs. The one that I had on the Decapod was the best nib I have ever written with. That soft medium was perfect. Like, just the performance was there all the way around.
I will say that I have two Nakaya pens, and neither made my top 10. Now, would those pens make my, you know, top 10 for favorite overall pens? Then probably. But when I was just talking about the nib, for me personally, the platinum nibs are a little bit too firm and a little bit too stiff. And so I have other ones that I care for more. They perform well, but if I'm, you know, making a list, then for the most part, some of the, whether it's the platinum president nib or the ones that are found on the Nakayas, which are basically platinum nibs, they are not my favorites. They're good, but they're just not my favorites.
That soft medium that I had on the Decapod Twist was perfect. It was just a really well done nib. I've come close to it. I've come close to getting that nib feel back, and I finally actually have that pen back in my collection after having it sit in Japan for 2.5 months because of karma. Both the dog and the act of force upon individuals. And now she's looking at me going, why are you talking about me into a microphone? This can't be good. So, before I went on my vacation over the summer, I was able to stumble my way into a Pilot 845. And as soon as I made the first payment to the owner who was selling it to me, I literally walked away from the pen for 5 minutes. I was in PayPal. I sent him the payment. I set the pen down on my nightstand and walked away for 5 minutes into my other room. And I come back, and Karma is sitting there with a pen in her mouth. Not the body of the pen, just the nib. It was so painful.
That's not how the pen is designed to be used, just letting you know.
Yeah, no. So she ended up eating the left tine off the nib. And I tried to be nice to the dog and not blame her, because saying my dog ate my nib is not something I ever want to have to say, even if it's true. So I blamed myself being stupid and tried to fix the nib to where it was at least serviceable. And then I finally bit the bullet and sent it off to Pilot and said, hey, please make this a working pen again. And thanks to all the things happening in the world, it took almost 3 months. But it is beautiful. I have a perfectly working 845 nib again.
Nice.
The 845 nib is my second favorite. It's my second best nib that I've ever used.
It's very soft. It's a very soft nib, and very nice with a little bit of feedback. It might have made my list.
I would say if they had that nib on the 823, the 823 would be the perfect pen.
Are they the same size?
I think they are. Both number 15s?
I don't know. You're going to make me get up and look.
Yeah, I'm going to make you get up and look. You're the one with the huge pen collection here.
Okay, just a second. I got the 823.
As we listen to the fig boot in his natural habitat, searching his drawers for two elusive Pilot pens. Okay. Will he find them?
Yeah, I got him here. I got him here. let's see here. They appear to be the same. They are both number 15 nibs.
I guess my big question, why couldn't Pilot just go ahead and double down on putting the two-tone nib on the 823?
I personally like the silver-colored nibs or the two-tone more than the straight gold, but on the, we call it brown color, I think that it works fine on the 823 that I have. I forgot the toffee or whatever. I forgot the actual name that they call it, but
amber.
The amber. I don't mind the straight gold-colored nib on the amber because I do think that that looks decent, but I don't mind it on there.
Yeah, fair enough. That does tie the amber together. But the two-tone would look so much better on the smoke.
Yeah, probably.
So I have to ask, why did you have to hate on Pelican and not make them your favorite?
I included them in honorable mentions. First of all, I think they make fantastic nibs. The quality on them is outstanding. I have never had a bad Pelican nib, other than maybe some of their very inexpensive models. But as far as the higher end models, I think they're outstanding. I think they're the consistency that you're going to get out of a Pelican nib is very high. You're not seeing lots of people get an out of the box experience that is negative with a Pelican nib. The 800 series is a medium and higher is extraordinarily glassy and extraordinarily smooth. And while I like that as an interesting experience, I like just a little bit more feedback as opposed to that glassy, smooth feeling. And when it comes to the M1000, it's like it's such a unique nib that is kind of unlike any other Pelican nib out there. It's just, first of all, it's so large. It has so much bounce, that you have a fine that writes like a double broad. So it's the sizing on it is a little peculiar.
Right.
And while I like it, and like I said, I liked it enough to have it just outside of the top 10. There was others that I just cared for more. I have no hate on either of those or the brand as a whole. There was just other ones I cared for more.
Okay, so here's something we can roundtable really quick. Where is your perfect level of tooth when it comes to your nib experience? Let's start with you, Urban.
That depends a bit on the pen. So I have a broad that's been turned into a stub or that's super wet. So there, I'm fine with it being fairly smooth. But in general, a bit of feedback is what I like best. If the nib is too smooth, I generally just take out the some sandpaper and make it a bit feedbacky, a bit more feedbacky than it was before. So super smooth isn't that nice for me, because it's also on some papers it just leads to skipping and hard starts, I find.
Okay. And what about you, David?
I think for me it depends on the size of the nib, to where, like, I have an extra fine nib on a Leonardo Momento Zero Grande that is amazing. I love that extra fine nib. But probably the reason I love it is so smooth, and that there is very little tooth on it. So for an extra fine nib, I don't mind something to be as smooth as possible. But then for some of the, we'll say, larger width nibs, I tend to prefer just a hair. I don't want it to be scratchy. I don't want to make it feel like there's a lot of drag and I'm writing with a unsharpened pencil, but that something along the lines of like a Sailor King of Pen nib, or even the Pilot 845, that there's just a hair of feedback there that that makes you realize you're writing with the fountain pen, that I enjoy.
So I have two schools here when it comes to feedback. The first one is review feedback. So when I'm reviewing a pen, I actually prefer that there's just a little bit of grab on the paper. Not much, but just a little. Like you said, so it reminds you that you're writing with a fountain pen. But for the personal collection, you know when you have a nib that is so smooth that it squeaks a little when you write on the page?
Yes.
That. Like, for my actual personal collection pens, that is what I prefer. So once a pen is safely in the collection and it's not going to be sold off, I try to do that to the nib if possible, if it's not already like that. Like, if it's got just a little bit of tooth, I'll leave it alone. If it's got a lot of tooth, then I get it to that point. I like actually hearing the squeak. I don't know why. I really don't. And some psychologist that listens to our podcast can probably let us know. Maybe it's some subconscious thing where I like to think that the ink appearing on the page is just magic and fountain pens don't work in the same realm of physics that everything else does. And that sentence is now on tape.
Unless you cut it out, of course.
Maybe I'll leave it in the patron-only version. Who knows? I'm sure the patrons will let us know. The reason I actually have to have the pen having a little bit more feedback during the reviews is it keeps me honest about my hand pressure on the paper, and it keeps me more consistent in how I'm writing from one review to the other. Whereas on the personal nibs, where they're glassy smooth and they're squeaky smooth, I lose track of that. So the pressure on the paper is very inconsistent, which makes for some really cool line variation and some really cool shading. But it doesn't provide that consistency that I want to be able to provide during the reviews that I put on YouTube. So
if there's too much feedback, then not that I'm only concerned about the comments, but if there's too much squeak, people complain about it. If it's too toothy, then people complain that it sounded too sharp. Not that I'm gonna say I don't care about comments, but I'm gonna do a review my way no matter what, regardless of what people think. But those are the kind of things that then people end up commenting about.
Well, you and I also do two very different styles of review. You do the actual talking head portion. You do the in the environment full immersion review. Whereas mine is almost like an infomercial.
Yeah.
I've got the backing track underneath to help mask some of the breathing. I don't have any of the folly of the pen actually making contact with the paper. It's very overly cinematic for mine, whereas yours is a legitimate review.
Well, yours is legitimate as well, so don't say it's illegitimate.
Yeah, I have to be more consistent in the voiceover, though, because I'll start off the videos with, "This week on the Inkwell, we're going to be taking a look at," and then insert product. And then by the end of the review, I'm just sitting there going, "So yeah, when you think about it, what we're looking at here." And so I go from this really nice voice to squeaky Southern California, and it's like, what the hell just happened?
I mean, you do it gradually enough that I'm not sure many people notice.
There's that. And then there's a couple times where I just go full on redneck when I'm doing a review.
I'm good about keeping my SoCal surfer roots out of my lingo when need be, but you know, yes, I in real life, I throw in dude way too much and can slip into, we'll call it Spicoli speak, a little, you know, mm-hmm. very easily, since that's where I spent the vast majority of my life in San Diego.
And I do a podcast in English, being German with an Italian. So that's yet another level.
Yeah. I mean, I always just find myself coming back to dude, man, and bro over and over and over again.
Well, no, it's bra. It's more bra. It's not bro. It's bra.
Well, actually, it's kind of changed into bruh. You don't even go bra anymore. You just go bruh. It's kind of weird. Like, you got to get even lazier with it.
Dude is kind of like my knee-jerk reaction. Like, you know, like I'd be in a crowd or something and some guy like bumps into me. That's like the first thing that comes out of my mouth. It's like, dude. That's like the first thing that just instinctively comes out of my mouth.
Whereas, like, someone does that to me, it's like, come on, bruh. That ain't cool, dude. Man, why you gotta be doing that? So I literally hit all three when that happens to me.
I just never leave the house, and I don't have that problem.
See, there you go. The best thing to do if you don't want to have to deal with any of those weird linguistic idiosyncrasies, just don't be social.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and turn this next topic into another round table. Do you have a stationary product or type of stationary product that you notice is cursed? Like, you get this type of stationary product or just anything in general, the whole things happen in threes immediately occurs to you. In my case, it's any fountain pen over $600. The second I cross that $600 threshold, within a month, something happens.
I mean, I'd have to make some experiments and try that because I've never spent that much money on a pen. So maybe it's the same for me. I don't know.
I can't think of anything on my end. My purchasing has slowed down tremendously as far as my personal collection. And so I haven't. The last thing I bought was a $110 pen as far as something new for the collection. But I can't remember. I was trying to look back through my list and think of like my last like real expensive pen that I purchased. I'm trying to think of that.
Well, and I mean, it doesn't actually have to be like you purchased above a threshold, but like a particular thing. I thought it was just Nakayas. I still think Nakayas are cursed.
Well, I'm thinking that every time I buy a Monte Winfield, then you have to sell your collection. I think that's the cursed thing. So maybe I need to stop buying Monte Winfields.
Okay, if that lines up, then it's not the Nakayas that are cursed. It's your Monte Winfields that are cursed. You are evil, sir. You are flat out evil. Although they were cool about it, so it's really not a horror story. Like, you did have that one pen that you dropped.
Yes, I did drop a very expensive pen on loan, and it is the first time I have damaged a expensive pen on loan, and I was freaking out, when that happened. And so I actually extracted the nib and sent it off to a nibmeister to repair it, and actually did something really stupid. I tried fixing it myself first, which was idiotic. I should have just left it alone and sent it off. And the nibmeister could have done the work and made it look like nothing had ever happened and no one would have been the wiser. But we'll just say my repairs that I attempted left a couple of little marks on the nib. And so since that happened, I had to fess up. And the retailer was very understanding and no harm, no foul. And I actually had to sent that pen off to a different reviewer. So sometimes pens get passed around through retailers and reviewers. And so I had to pass that one off and then explain to that reviewer, you know, hey, don't knock this nib. It works fine, but don't knock that little scratch on the nib. It didn't come that way. That was my little addition.
You say you freaked out a little bit at that. You messaged me about that. If that's you freaking out, you are one of the most even keel people on the face of the earth.
When it rolled off the table and landed nib first on the ground and the, you know, the bend back that was on that nib, that was, well, especially since I had It's one thing if you damage your own pen, but if it's somebody else is right. loaning you a, you know, $5,000 pen and with the trust that you're going to return it in one piece and you jack it up, then there is an initial fear that comes with that. So that did not feel good.
Wait. What was it on one that was actually up in that ballpark? I know it was in the four digits, but was it really that high up in the ballpark?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think it was like in the $4,000 range, 45, 48, something like that. Yeah. It was not a cheap pen. So, but yes, it is. The nib was repaired. There is a little scratch on the nib, and, you know, you might be seeing it on another channel sometime soon. One thing that it's somewhat similar that I thought was funny is, you know, how like a company, what will happen is a manufacturer will, let's just say like Visconti will send one sample of a particular pen to the US. And then what happens is that one, they literally send one pen, and then that one pen gets passed around between all of the retailers. And then the retailers take their pictures, and they, you know, it's like, okay, you get this pen for 2 days, and they get the pen, they take their pictures for their online catalog and their print catalogs, then they ship it off to the next retailer, and it just kind of goes around in circles. And if you take a look at the ever see a Visconti Homo sapiens Skylight, the one with the smaller ink window, it's funny because there was a little glue or something like that inside the ink window to where it wasn't quite perfect. And you can tell on every picture from every retailer, you can tell it's the same pen because it has the same little imperfection in the window. So I just thought that was funny because you could look at everyone's pictures and you could, you know, because most of the time it just looks like a generic pen, you know, but you could tell that all of the little ink windows have this, you know, it almost kind of looks like someone inked it and there's like a little moisture in it, but it was something like some of the glue or something like that in this one specific model that got sent around. And so, yeah, all the pictures for all the retailers, you could see it was the same pen, which amused me because that was the exact same pen that then I got sent for review, which is why I noticed it. Cause I was like, wait a second, this is the exact same pen that got pictures taken of it. And so, yeah, so that's how pens kind of make their way around like that, because they'll have like one pen that gets sent all the way around, and then once they're available, then they get their whole stock. But I thought that might be an interesting story.
And wow. You know, eventually I will be on that list. I'm at 1,100 subscribers right now. I'll eventually get there.
You'll get there.
Make sure no dogs are in the room with those pens then.
Yeah. Honestly, I think the biggest thing that would keep me off that list is I am on record on at least 8 podcast episodes now having described a fountain pen horror story in one way or another.
Yeah. Also, don't stir your coffee with loaner pens.
I haven't done that. I actually have a new pen in the collection that has broken me of that habit because it's made out of wood.
I mean, if it's, I don't know, stabilized, should be fine to stir the coffee, I think.
Yeah, well, I also still don't actually technically own this pen yet.
I had another pen. I don't damage pens that often, but I had it was my Visconti. It was called a Visconti Millionaire. It's made out of marble. And I dropped the pen, and then if you look at my review of the Millionaire, I actually recreate it. I recreate me dropping my pen, and, you know, kind of do it in black and white and slow motion. And I like made this little plastic replica pen to come dropping on the ground. But yes, I dropped it and sufficiently destroyed the nib and had to send it back to Kohl's of London and have them. And that I had to pay for that myself and pay for a replacement nib, but it was worthwhile. Cause that's one of my favorite nibs in any of my Viscontis is that nib that's on that Millionaire. And it's just their 23 karat palladium nib, but it's very, very nice. But yeah, I destroyed the first one somewhere. I think they sent it back to me. I think I still have the old, you know, reverse Fude nib or whatever it looks like now.
The most recent, well, no, not the most recent Faber Castell video I did, because that was the Hexo. By the way, David, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
My older brother says thank you as well.
Did he end up with the pen?
He ended up with the pen. He needed something a little bit thicker of a line width than the Conklin that I gave him for a birthday gift a couple years ago. And I was like, hey, it's a medium nib. You like rose gold materials. So here's a pen. Here's the cartridge that comes with the pen. And here is a needle, so you can refill that cartridge with whatever ink you want.
Yeah, Faber-Castell was nice enough to send me a number of those, and it was like, okay, what am I going to do with six of them or something? And so it was like, I think I gave three or four away, and then you ended up with one, and then I kept one for myself. So it was like I ended up giving them away.
Now I'm the only one who hasn't tried it, right?
Yeah, you're the only one that hasn't tried it. Were you expecting me to go with, like, a different color other than the rose gold when you asked me which color I wanted?
I figured, you know, you had a choice, and so, you know, do whichever you'd like.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good writing pen for being a budget pen. It's actually a really good out-of-the-box pen. Mm-hmm. I was surprised.
How much does it cost in the U.S.?
$42.
Oh, it's like 20, yeah. 25 here, 25 euros.
Yeah, well, we have to pay the America tax.
That's true.
Freedom tax, excuse me.
Okay, fine. The freedom tax. I'll take my freedom tax with my freedom fries and my freedom beer. Thank you very much.
As opposed to your VAT.
But good things come from VATs. I mean, come on. You get High Point beer. You get High Point lager. You get real whiskey. Those things are done in VATs.
I just like it whenever I don't have to pay it, to where they like say it and then they're like, you don't got to pay that. You don't have to pay that. Okay, good. Good. I don't.
Yeah, it's especially annoying when you look at all the Dutch pages for various companies and they say, oh, that's the price for the four. If you're not in the in Europe, and then I have to pay another 21%, I think it is.
Oh, ouch. That is painful.
But hey, on the other hand, I don't pay for university and stuff, so I guess it's fine.
Yeah, that is true. I hate you for that. But yeah, the other Faber-Castell I did, the Faber-Castell, Graf von Faber-Castell Classic. So the guy that I bought the Parker Duofold for is going to sell me the Classic, but he also sold me a Sailor 1911 Large Stormy Seas, and he also sold me my 823, which when he offered to sell me the 823 for like $100, how could I say no?
Of course.
And then when he sold me the Stormy Seas for $100, how could I say no?
I mean, for the 823, that's like as much, basically as much as the, is it the Jinhao knockoff? Is that the Jinhao that makes the 823 knockoff?
Wing Sun.
Yeah, that's one. Wing Sun. Yes. They were selling the gold nibbed one for like $95 or something like that. And then, the steel nibbed one was a lot cheaper, but yes. Yeah, you're right. It's the Wing Sun.
Yeah, around 25, I'd say.
Wow. Knockoffs everywhere. But yeah, after I filmed the Classic video, I said in there, the one thing I hate most of all when it comes to this pen is the fact that I have to give it back. I don't want to give it back. First, he comments on the video correcting me what type of wood it was, because I got it wrong. It's the same wood that clarinets are made out of, not the fingerboards for stringed instruments like violins. So it's a different type of wood. He corrected me there, rightfully so. But then I get a text message a couple minutes later. Yeah, I want to get a different Faber-Castell, and I paid $400 for it. I'll sell it to you for $200.
Hmm, nice.
So, one, he's evil. Two, see number one. And three, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and buy the pen, because that two-tone gold nib on the Faber-Castell Classic is just beautiful. And it squeaks. I am sold on the squeak. And he got a Parker Duofold at a pretty good price. So, hey. That's kind of weird, though. Do you ever... I'm guessing, David, you don't ever have that happen to you, but do you ever have people just sit there and go, hey, I've got this pen. I'll sell it to you for, like, super cheap.
Yeah. Or, you know, I've gotten a couple of recent emails from people that were like, hey, you know, my friend is selling this for this. Do you want it? Or things along those lines, or somebody, or they email with folks email me with, you know, wanting to make their buying decisions for them. So where, hey, I just got, you know, this is a Mont Blanc that retails for like $3,000 and they're offering it to me for 15. Should I buy it? You know, type of thing. And, you know, I part of me doesn't want to be responsible if, you know, you don't like it, then you're going to blame me for saying, yeah, you should buy it at $1,500. It's a good bargain. But, I do get people asking from time to time or saying that they, you know, I was just given this whole collection of, an estate sale and we're looking to sell these pens. Are you interested in any of them and type of things like that? So that those things have happened.
So I guess for you, because you've developed such a good relationship with the vendors and everything, like what was that first moment where you knew, wait a second, people actually kind of consider me in such a way that they're willing to hand me this $100, multi-$100 thing?
I think that there's too many times there's people that they, whether it's influencers or things like that, that they kind of get a big head and they get above themselves and think a lot of themselves and try to ask for more than they deserve, so to speak. I had someone not long ago email me to say, or maybe it was even through Instagram. I can't remember. I think it was through Instagram. They basically said, hey, I'm 16 years old. I'm going to start a pen review channel. Do you think you could, you know, he hasn't produced any reviews yet, but you know, I'm going to start it. Do you think you can send me your Namiki Emperor on loan to review? And my answer politely was, hell no. I'm not letting that one, you know, I'm not letting my best friends borrow that one, but you know, they've got a, but the fact that someone would ask for that, I understand what, you know, the relationship that I have with retailers and with distributors and manufacturers, you know, it's a symbiotic relationship that, you know, they're not providing me something out of the goodness of their own heart, that they're providing me something because it's a marketing expense and that they're hoping to sell more pens for the extra exposure and things like that. And so, you know,
And you put in the time to build that relationship.
Oh, yes, absolutely. There are some relationships that took me years to develop over time, right, you know, with companies that had never worked with reviewers previously. And I'm very proud of those relationships because I like to think I'm very professional and that I'm not, you know, bugging them just to say like, hey, man, give me a pin. Or, you know, hey, basically just looking for something for free. It's, you know, kind of more of a business relationship. But obviously, I'm going to state my own opinion and, you know, that hopefully the opinion doesn't prevent us from working together again. But it really is working together because it is very symbiotic. They're helping provide the product and then I'm helping provide some of the marketing and content. Like my first thing that anyone ever gave me was through a retailer. And rather than me, first of all, I waited until I actually had a few subscribers. And then I didn't ask the retailer to send me something just straight for free. It wasn't, hey, I do reviews. Will you send me something? I actually said, hey, I am buying this pen. I am purchasing this from your company. Do you mind throwing in a second one and I'll do a review and then I'll give that pen away? And so it was kind of like meeting them halfway as far as I wasn't necessarily right, asking for something for free. In the retail world, you know, maybe they came close to breaking even on me buying that one pen and then giving the other one away. And so, you know, that was kind of the approach I took to begin with, as opposed to the, hey, here's my channel. I do reviews. Send me something free.
Until I develop a relationship with that retailer where they offer, hey, okay, we'll give you a little bit of a discount. If they sit there and turn around and go, yeah, we're going to offer you a 75% discount on it, I'm going to look at them side-eyed and go, are you sure we can't just do a 20% discount? I want to feel like I'm actually paying for the product here. Can we do that, please? Please? By the way, I'm going to tangent us for a second. because I was scrolling through Instagram because a certain Fig Boot mentioned Instagram. So this is your fault. Colorverse posted a picture with a new ink called Clear Cyan.
I saw that. That looked very watery.
It looks very watery, but when you go to the fourth picture on it and they show the swatch, I think the Inkedwell has the unsung moniker of the turquoise channel. This ink, I think I may have to buy.
I'm interested how, okay, because that looks like it was almost brushed. I'm just looking at that picture that they did, and it was almost brushed on there. And so I'm wondering how thick that is, as opposed to what that line looks like coming out of a pen. Now, in the fourth picture, they do have it coming out of a pen. But, yeah, it does look rather watery. And so who knows? Maybe, you know, I have seen things where the ink in the picture doesn't necessarily look like the ink that shows up. So, who knows? But yeah, that does look a little bit on the watery side, but it does appear, at least on the last page, to be a little bit darker through a nib.
You know, that actually kind of leads to an interesting tangent here, because we were kind of talking about it. Top three ink bottles. I'm reserving the final spot for this topic. So yeah, we'll go ahead and start with you, David. Top three ink bottles with justifications.
Urashizuku, that's very high on my list. I love those bottles. Like, love the teardrop at the bottom. I think that adds a nice look to it. That it's a decent sized bottle. You can get any size nib in it. I like the fact that it's narrow and tall, as opposed to the abhorred sailor bottles that are short and fat, and that the little ink cup that's in there never quite works right for big nibs. And so while I like some of their ink, I despise those shapes of bottles that they have. But high on my list is the Pilot Urashizuku line.
Okay. What do you got in your second place there?
You know, I've always liked the Ackerman bottles as well. I thought that they have an interesting design. I always kind of like the marble design on top. I will say that there are times when some of my Ackerman inks get a little crusty on top, and so it's a little hard to take the cap off of it. But I think,
and then the inner thing just sticks, right?
I haven't had the problem with the ball sticking. It's more the cap. And so sometimes I have to...
Yeah, it separates into two parts.
Yeah, I had one cap break on me. So I'm having to store that one in a... It's literally stored in a plastic bag, because in my drawers, I have to... All of the inks are laid on their side, and the cap is slightly cracked. And if for some reason it leaks, now it's inside of a bag as opposed to on its own. But Ackerman bottles are high on my list. And for looks, even though I wish they were glass, the Visconti bottles, I always kind of like the looks of the Visconti bottle as well, with the kind of the narrow base and the wider top. I think it looks interesting. Plus, it has a cool video game tie, because I was playing BioShock Infinite a few years ago, and when you're walking mm-hmm. around, there are ink bottles strewn about all the offices, and they look exactly like the Visconti bottle. So I don't know if the Visconti bottle was based on something else, or a classic design, or if the makers of BioShock Infinite copied the Visconti bottle to put into their game. But it's fun to see that shape of a bottle.
Not a bad top three. What about you, Urban?
Definitely not in the top three are the Diamine bottles for me. I mean, the 30 mil anyway, because the opening is so small that almost no pens fit into it. But even the bigger 80 mil, you can fill a pen until the bottle is maybe half empty, and then it's impossible. Yeah, I like the Ackerman bottles as well. And this traditional Pelican style, those 4001 bottles, they're nice, I think. You can also tilt them a bit. They're small enough that it's much easier than with the Diamond bottles. So I like those, the Pelican 4001 or Kaweco or any other number of brands. Yeah, I think the Lamy, the big Lamy bottles are also
Yeah, those nice. Are good. I'll throw as an honorable mention the Mont Blanc boots. I like the Mont Blanc boots as well.
Okay. That's a pretty good set. Off the top, KWZ, they are my favorite. I mean, like, you just get a metric ton of ink in a wide mouth bottle, so you can fit any pen in there imaginable. Maybe it's because I tend to use a syringe anyways for filling the majority of my pens. I'm really not put off as much by not being able to get the nib in there for every last drop. So I'm kind of the exception to the rule there. But just the sheer amount of ink that you get, the size of the bottle opening that you get, the fact that it's a glass bottle is also amazing. And just every time I open up a KWZ ink, just that lovely vanilla smell that comes from it is just perfect. I know that's the ink more than the bottle, but still. For me, that is perfection. A close second, and this one actually kind of got me yelled at a little bit in the comments section. The vintage Pelican 4001 Königsblau bottles. I like that short, squat, square bottle. I like the look of it. That is one where I wish they had come up with a little bit of a better reservoir, made the reservoir portion a little bit deeper or something, kind of mimicked the Mont Blanc boot. Like, aesthetically, that bottle is my number two. Purely for function, though, I've got to put Oroshizuku at number three. That bottle has the perfect lip width to get a pen in there. And like David said, that little the little divot at the bottom is perfect to get that last drop, as long as you're using a smaller nib. Anything above a number six, I've noticed that I still have to go back to the old trusty syringe to get the last little bit of ink out of there.
I am close to finishing my second bottle of Konpeki. I have finished a Konpeki, and I'm like three quarters of the way finishing a second bottle of Konpeki.
I think I gave my bottle of Konpeki to my older brother. I can't remember. I gave him like four or five bottles of ink. I'm slowly but surely trying to turn him into a normal human being, and I think fountain pens is the way to do it. We're this close to a breakthrough, and I think I'm almost there. He watches the YouTube channel. I'm sure he occasionally listens to the podcast. He's got two fountain pens now and at least eight bottles of ink. So he's almost a normal human being.
Now, what did you feel about the ink bottle that I'm holding in my hand right now from Krishna?
Well, my first thought was, when did you start a crack habit? But then after I realized it was an ink bottle and not paraphernalia, I envied you like no other, because that is one of the trippiest looking ink bottles on the face of the earth. And I really like the layover reservoir design that they went with.
But it also looks fairly impractical.
There are certain things about that are a challenge. We don't need to go into the whole story, but it was interesting just because they had sent me the bottle, and then literally the next day they had to halt production. And so I had this bottle that I thought was literally never going to be produced, and so I really couldn't show it or do anything with it. And then they finally were able to come up with a deal with a different manufacturer, and they were able to then produce them, so that's why I was able to show it. But there are... It looks cool. There are a couple of things about it that I think might be a challenge. And I think one of the things I mentioned was, like, when you go to open it, your hand kind of goes to the larger ball, and then you're twisting on the smaller arm. And that puts a lot of pressure on the joint that's between the two. And I don't know if like that lid is ever really hard and you're putting a lot of force, if it's possible to just literally snap that off. So you have to make it a point to kind of hold both sides of it when you're uncapping it, as opposed to only holding that one. Because that would be a bad thing if you snap off the arm and then all of a sudden you have an ink gusher just happening. So,
and it's also Super Sheena, right?
Yes, so. Very dark Super Sheena.
That's $18 for that.
It's not that bad. The ink is decent. It's very similar to, you know, it's a heavy sheening blue ink, kind of almost like the KWZ sheen machine, somewhat.
Or like anything that came from Organic Studio?
Not quite as much. It isn't.
Oh, okay.
Those are more sheen than ink. So it's not quite as bad. So it's, it's interesting. Also, it's a little interesting just because it, when you get it, it doesn't look like you're receiving that much ink, because the ink is like half of what's in the chamber. And so it almost looks like half empty when you get it, just because of the way the physics need to work. I kind of wish there was more ink in it to begin with, but I don't know if it's because of the physics of it, if you could actually put more in it and have it work right. But when you get it, it's like half full, if that makes sense.
I will say one thing. I like the cardboard sleeve that it comes in, because it reminds me of like a Glenlivet or any of those scotches. That's what it kind of reminds me of. So that's a good touch right there.
Yeah, it's like a tin. It's a metal tin, almost like something you'd buy.
Oh, wow.
It's something almost like you'd buy tea in. It very well might be a tea container, and then they just put the ink in it. But it's very padded. There's some cutout custom padding in it, so it should ship with no issues, or at least I think it's going to ship with no issues.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, now that I know it's an actual production thing and not a pseudo production thing, I'm actually going to get one, because that is a cool bottle. That would actually make a really cool set dressing for the YouTube desk.
Yeah, it is limited edition. I can't remember if it was like 2,000 or something like that, or 3,000, but there was a limited amount that they were going to produce, and that was it. It's not going to be a regular production thing. Once they're gone, they're gone.
Well, I will definitely have to keep an eye on that then. One last thing I wanted to touch on before we call it a day and I have to get to work. The 845 is finally being released in the U.S. And they're charging almost a dollar. They're charging a little over a dollar per number in the name for the price. What do you feel about the 845 retailing for $850 when you could order it from Japan for like $450 to $550, depending on where you get it from?
Did they look at Pelican and thought they'd do the same thing?
Apparently. But yeah, you're looking at $850 for the custom 845 to get it in the U.S.
That's a lot. That's a lot.
I love the 845, but it is not an $850 pen. I'm sorry. I cap it at $600.
I agree that I think that that's a bit excessive for that pen, even though it is one of my favorites. It's very, very good. You know, that's a whole other discussion in regard to the pricing structures of different markets and whether you should stay in your own market or purchase from outside of your market and the risks and rewards of doing such. So that's a whole other topic. But right. I do like that they're at least opening that up, because there's a lot of other Pilot pens that I had to go over to Asia to purchase because they didn't have them here. There was a lot of the 742, 743, and there was some, I can't remember the other ones. There was the whole custom and custom heritage, the custom lineup. There was I'm really not a completist. I believe I have one of every one of those types of pens in the custom lineup. And so in order to complete that collection, I had to purchase from Asia, because those aren't like the 742 and 741. I'm trying to remember all of the numbers, but some of those are just not available in the US. But yeah, I was able to kind of complete that and have one of each of those pens.
My thing there, if the company is willing to honor warranty work, regardless of which market you buy it in, I don't have a problem buying in a different market that you live in. But if the company puts a line in the sand of where the warranty work is, then that means the company wants you to stay within your market. And at that point, I honor the company's wishes and do that.
Yeah, it seems like the options, at least for me personally, the options have been minimized over the last couple of years. There was a few other retailers that were easier to purchase from out of other regions, and it seems like there's some of those retailers are no longer with us, at least in the capacity in which they were before, where you could purchase things, especially things like Pilot, for the Asian price as opposed to the Western U.S. price. And that was very attractive to do. You could still do that, but there is significantly more hoops that you have to jump through.
Yeah, definitely, for sure. One last thing. For people that want to actually organize their pen drawers, where can they get pen trays that will actually sit in a desk drawer?
I get this question a lot. Inevitably, whenever I show some pen trays on my channel, I have no affiliation with this site, but where I always point people to is gopens.com. There was a couple of sites I actually just checked a while ago. There's a couple of sites I used, and the other site is no longer in business. So if you go to gopens.com, they have a wide variety of colored slots or colored trays that you could purchase. They're very easy to cut with scissors so that, you know, if you need to shorten them or make adjustments to them in order to fit your drawer, then you could do so. But, and they have them in a number of different colors. But I think that you can't just buy one. Or maybe I guess you can buy one. But for like 1 to 10, they're $8 each. So typically, you're usually not just buying one. You're buying a few of them. But
right.
But yeah, that's where I typically go in the past when I have purchased them.
Well, definitely going to put that in the show notes. Thank you for being on the show again. It's always a pleasure to have you on. And this time, Urban actually got to be on the show when we had a guest.
Yes, the first time, I think. Otherwise, the other times, I think it was when I was on holiday, right?
Yeah, which is why I had to get guests. But this time, I figured I'd be nice and actually make sure you could talk to the interesting people.
That's nice of you.
What can I do, especially now that I'm the second fiddle? But go check out Urban's podcast, Expanding Beyond, if that's your kind of thing. Also, check out Borderline Genius, because that actually sounds interesting. As always, you can find David over at, where can they find you?
Figboot at Pens on YouTube, as well as on Instagram. I'm at Figboot11.
Figboot11. Okay. As always, you can find me at, well, on YouTube, at The Inkedwell. On this podcast, on Patreon at patreon.com/Yevgeny, because nothing screams Patreon like a really hard first name. Till next time, though, say goodbye.
Bye-bye.